Hey everyone, welcome back to the 443 Security Simplified. I'm your host, Mark the Liberty, and joining me today is...
Arr, Corey Salty Knockrider.
And here there be monsters.
On today's episode, we're
going to be talking about a couple monsters. Watch out, Microsoft.
Yeah, we'll be going over the recent Exchange zero-day vulnerabilities in a bit of a deep dive. What they are, how they work, how to protect yourself, and a few other interesting tangents that we can take off of that topic. And then we'll...
Sorry about that.
No, we're not. And then we'll dive into the world of rats being delivered over images that are actually archives that are all just kind of messed up and overzealous on archivers. With that...
Get your cats out.
Let's go ahead and unarchive our way in. Oh, that was too ham-fisted.
Compress our way in? I do have a compressor running on this audio.
Let's get started.
I'm kidding,
so it has now been, by the time you're listening to this, a few weeks since Microsoft released patches and then also disclosed four actively exploited zero-day vulnerabilities in Exchange Server. But since their announcement, like, man, it has completely snowballed out of control. So to backtrack a little bit, 2 weeks ago, Microsoft put out an advisory and a couple of emergency patches for four zero-day vulnerabilities that in their disclosure, they stated they saw a foreign threat actor, which they called Hafnium out of China, actively exploiting these flaws, which is why they patched them 1 week before Patch Tuesday. The vulnerabilities themselves, it was a series of four of them that the threat actors were chaining together to basically gain full root level access to Exchange servers. They were unauthenticated vulnerabilities, meaning if you chain them together correctly, all you needed was a Exchange server exposed to the internet with HTTP access, which a lot of Exchange servers are, thanks to Outlook Web Access.
OWA, thank you very much.
Even if the first of the vulnerabilities we'll discuss gets patched or mitigated, they could still continue their exploit chain and compromise the server just by getting a hold of an administrator account. So even with the unauthenticator bit removed, it's still a pretty serious chain of vulnerabilities.
Luckily, they're all patched, so you don't have to worry about the one or the other as long as you get the patch.
Yes, correct. And that's basically the first bit of guidance from Microsoft was patch them. But let's I think we should dive into the actual vulnerabilities since we haven't discussed
them before. Cool they're, for the nerds.
Yeah, they're cool in a holy crap, this is pretty bad for a lot of organizations kind of way.
I think people know by now, even though we think bad guys, cyber criminals are bad. It is kind of cool the way you can use unintended consequences of software vulnerabilities to take control. So cool in a bad way. And I think you already pointed out that this is interesting in the fact that it is an attack chain of vulnerabilities. It's always interesting. Granted, some of these are still individually pretty severe. It's not the case of lots of little weak vulnerabilities somehow making one big one. But I always find chain exploits interesting.
Exactly. So let's start with the first one. The first vulnerability in the chain is a server-side request forgery. So what that means is basically web servers, typically you will make a request to them. Like I send a GET request to google.com and I get the contents of the page. I send a POST request to login.google.com and I can log into my account. On the flip side, though, web servers also tend to make connections out to other resources as well. So maybe if I'm trying to log into my account, that server I'm connecting to will send a POST request off to some other like SAML resource in order to verify my identity and give me access. And this first vulnerability allows an attacker to trick the web server into making a request to anywhere, including the server itself. And so long story short, as part of the exploit chain, the attacker could force the server to make a request to itself and successfully authenticate as the server, which is kind of funny when you think of it like that way, but basically it's allowing them to bypass authentication and then assume the identity of the server account in this case, which is a privileged administrator account because the server needs to be able to do actions on itself, basically. Now, this makes the full exploit chain pretty easy. Because again, you don't need to compromise an account beforehand. You just need to be able to issue a HTTPS request to the web server on Exchange. But the threat actor can still carry out the rest of the chain without exploiting this flaw. If they can phish an administrator at either account or compromise it by guessing the password or some other way. As we've talked about before, there are a million different ways to steal someone's password these days. Now, the second vulnerability in this chain is a little more technical. It's an insecure deserialization vulnerability, which it's actually one of the OWASP top 10 vulnerabilities out there. It's a pretty common and serious flaw across web applications because it can be pretty difficult to defend against if you don't think about every angle. So as an explanation, some applications that use data in a variety of formats these days on the web, when you're sending data to a website or it's sending data to some other application, it's typically using JSON or XML to communicate that data. Sometimes though, web applications and other applications will need to serialize that data into some other form, like just a raw buffer of bytes and bits, and then deserialize it once it gets to the other end. And that little bit can cause some problems. It's pretty common in Java, for example, not JavaScript, but Java has really common deserialization issues, where when it's converting from one data type to another, deserializing it, it could actually enable code execution based off of how Java handles this deserialization. I think we've probably seen a few dozen deserialization issues in Java that could lead to code execution over the last decade or so.
Would you say this is just, I generically sometimes call them parsing flaws, where if you have an engine that's going from one type of encoding to another, I mean, essentially that's what serialization and deserialization is. Writing a message in one way to send it and then unextracting that one way at the other end. And anytime you write a parsing engine, you're taking inputs the entire time to do an action. So anytime you take an input on a computer system, it's an opportunity to trick the parser to do something it shouldn't. You know, I'm simplifying it, Mark. So tell me if it's the analogy makes it less technically correct. But is it similar to any issue you'll find in these parsing engines?
Yeah, that is the street credless CTO overview of it.
Hey, I'm trying to simplify. I actually know what serialization is. I'm just trying to make it easy.
Yes, and thank you for doing that. Now, you're right, it is basically a parsing error. There's other issues outside of just parsing data and having an issue that could cause code execution. Like other common deserialization issues could be like if the user has control of any of the inputs or the serialized data at any point during the transfer, they could go in there and modify it and elevate their privileges. Like one common issue, or at least commonly exploited issue in PHP apps or other apps that use JSON or PHP serialized objects, is if the user has access to that and you, for example, put their account type somewhere in there, they could change their account type. And then when the engine goes to deserialize it, suddenly they're an administrator on the system. So in this case, though, there was an insecure deserialization vulnerability on Exchange server that could enable an attacker to then run arbitrary code with system privileges on the Exchange server. Now, this is an authenticated vulnerability, meaning they actually have to have administrative access to the server in order to hit this API and trigger the vulnerability. But again, they could either exploit that first flaw, the server-side request forgery one, or they could just steal an administrator's account and log in and exploit this that way. So that gives them code execution on the server. Then there were two more vulnerabilities in this exploit chain, and both of them were just arbitrary file write vulnerabilities that basically lets an attacker write a file to anywhere on the server. So now put together with a just Exchange server sitting out there on the open, unpatched with OWA exposed, a threat actor can go in and log in as an admin, use that to then write a malware file, a web shell, something anywhere they want on the server, and then execute that with system level privileges. That's about as serious of an exploit chain as you get on any application.
Yeah, I mean, you have a system level rat. A web shell is essentially a web version of a rat sitting on a system. And by the way, obviously, Exchange OWA servers are typically This is an on-premise Exchange server flaw, so it's not really the case that you're using only O365 cloud stuff. But when you have on-premise mail servers, they tend to be sitting in privileged network locations. So having a backdoor on the Exchange server is a pretty easy step to compromising all of that private network.
Yeah, exactly. So originally when Microsoft released the patch a couple Tuesdays ago now and disclosed the vulnerability, the reason they did it as an emergency patch was because it was being actively exploited in the wild. And they named Hafnium, which is a threat actor group based out of China, as the ones that were doing it. And it was within a few days then that just about every threat actor under the sun started scanning for vulnerable servers and attempting to exploit them.
Yeah, this is a low. You should expect this with all Microsoft patches, but especially if there's an emergency patch that really takes a one HTTP or HTTPS query thing and turns it into a remote root, remote system in Windows case. It's even if they haven't disclosed enough details, bad guys know where to look, and they know enough about the four flaws that they're going to find it and they're going to use it too. So the second, was it March 2nd at 2 p.m. that Microsoft posted this, you know, every threat actor in the world learned about it and are like, hey, let's go pop some Exchange servers.
Let's go pop some shells.
Pop some web shells. I feel like I'm back in the 2000s.
Yeah, exactly. So along with Hafnium now, researchers have found that ESET just published that they're seeing at least 10 major hacking organizations attempting to exploit this. The National Parliament of Norway just announced that they are one of the victims of this attack. Saw updates that hundreds of organizations out of the UK have been compromised by this now. And it makes sense because, like we just said a bit ago, with an on-premise Exchange server, typically you enable users to access their mail from outside the organization, which means exposing Outlook web access to the internet. And by exposing it, then you're vulnerable to this attack. The latest news is basically, you know, if you have not patched your Exchange server by now, especially by now when you're listening to this, you should expect that it has been hit and exploited and you've been compromised.
Yeah,
because it is that easy of an attack.
There is a script to check this, by the way. Hopefully none of the people listening to this comes as a surprise to you. Hopefully you patched long ago. But besides the patch, the next step I'm sure we'll talk about is a script to look for some of the web shells and other indicators of compromise that would be in your OWA directories if this has happened to you.
Yep. In Microsoft's KB, they've done a really good job of both describing the issue, describing the threat actors, but also providing guidance and indicators of compromise to see if you've been hit. They've got a whole list of IOCs on their GitHub. They've also got them described throughout the disclosure document. And then, like you said, they've got a PowerShell script that you can run, and it'll just automatically for you check to make sure if any of those IOCs exist on your networks and let you know.
Even has a fancy progress bar.
That's the sign of a great script. I'm telling you, as someone that writes scripts, like, it's a pain in the ass to make a progress bar that actually works.
By the way, they never do. They're all estimates. So many go to 100% and sit for another 30 seconds before they get there.
You make a good point. This is a Microsoft progress bar we're talking about.
Okay, actually, you're right. Maybe the progress bar is a bad thing. It's not going to be right. But it makes you feel good to watch.
Exactly. I mean, it gives you something to do, but it is a Microsoft progress bar. So for all you know, 1% is nearly done and 99% means there's 3 hours left.
Yep.
For this vulnerability, the easy mitigation is just patch your dang servers. There's patches out for everything from Exchange 2010 all the way up to the latest editions. That said, so Exchange 2010 is only vulnerable to the deserialization vulnerability, which is still pretty bad on its own. It's safe from the other ones, but 2013, 2016, and 2019 are vulnerable to the full suite. If you're for some reason
ironic situation where despite us telling you to patch an update, older seems a little bit better.
Yeah. Well, they even in their disclosure said that the out of support, like what is it, Exchange 2008 or something is the one before 10. They said they don't think it's vulnerable. Even if it was, they're not going to fix it. Just upgrade. It's not like the courtesy of Windows XP where 3 years out of support, they still patch for the Eternal Blue vulnerabilities. Still pretty serious. Like, it's been gaining a lot of news. So like, let's say like, even if you do have a vulnerable system and you patched it and you want to know like other mitigation strategies for similar issues in the future.
Yeah, we should talk about that. And by the way, we're going to talk about just not general ones and WatchGuard ones. But before we talk about that, I love talking about WatchGuard and how we help, but I want to be very clear. You should patch this. And honestly, the mitigations we're going to tell you, this is a zero-day flaw people were exploiting before these mitigations existed. Not just for WatchGuard, but every company out there telling you they have mitigations for this. Guess what? They released it after March 2nd. So the only reason we're sharing this is if there's any business critical reason that you can't get the patch in Exchange right away, this will save your butt right now, after you still need to check if you weren't compromised 4 weeks ago, because who knows how long this has been going on. But it will help you kind of close that vulnerability window right this minute. But the truth is, you know, all the companies that are trying to help you check for this now, those checks weren't in place when China was sending these attacks out. Or, I'm sorry, allegedly, the Chinese threat actors allegedly were sending these attacks out.
Allegedly, I guess we do have to cover our butts, but Microsoft were pretty explicit in name dropping which threat actors.
But I did say China. This isn't all of China. This is a threat actor. This is a threat, specifically a threat actor group in China. I have lots of friends there that are actually on the White Hat side.
So when it comes to mitigations, like, obviously by now, 2 weeks after the fact, just about every security vendor under the sun has intrusion prevention signatures to detect the exploits, which is great. Even outside that, though, because
to note, it's actually not, Mark knows this, but not to detect the exploits, to really detect that first. I mean, three of these exploits are really kind of local vulnerabilities. So the signatures we have are for that server-side request forgery. I believe that's the main one that can be exploited over HTTP or HTTPS. Maybe we should talk about that too.
Yeah. So what I was going to say is, yes, these flaws are all exploited over HTTPS, like HTTP, unencrypted access.
I was going to say, likely these flaws should all be exploited over HTTPS, but I believe you can actually still configure an OWA server in HTTP if you go against all defaults. Like, why? According to a 2020 article specifically asking why can't users connect with HTTP, you know, you can go and disable the setting that says require secure channel. Now, hopefully you don't. All the OWA installs are going to default to HTTPS. I believe they also default to, if you go to HTTP, they will redirect you forcefully to HTTPS. But I think it's actually technically possible to still run it in HTTP. I assume none of you are doing that, but I think it might be technically possible.
If there's a Darwin Award for security, yeah, like, I think at that point, you might
even Microsoft doesn't want you to do that. The fact that they don't force it is kind of interesting, but I assume it's just because there's customers that complained and they have to allow you to downgrade yourself to oblivion, frankly.
Yeah.
We suspect most of these are going to be HTTPS, and that's how bad guys are. That's what it's going to happen over 443. But technically, you might still be able to have an OWA server with HTTP only.
But for the overwhelming majority of IT admins out there that have this configured
for the smart people
for HTTPS only, yes, these attacks do take place over an encrypted connection, which means, like, by default, your network perimeter is not going to be able to see into that. That said, there are ways to get around that. Like, on the Firebox, for example, we've got HTTPS inspection through our HTTPS proxy, which basically does a man-in-the-middle connection for encrypted traffic that goes through it. We've talked about it a few times, even just 2 weeks ago, talking about inspecting outbound traffic from your network, where it can actually be a bit of a pain to set up because, you know, you have to deploy a certificate to different hosts that they all trust, or get one signed and imported on the Firebox, and then handle use cases. On the flip side, though, for this inbound HTTPS traffic to a web server you're protecting, it's easy. Like, you just take the web server cert that you were going to stick on that server and stick it on the Firebox instead. And now it acts as the first hop in that. It can decrypt the connection and then re-encrypt it still for your internal network and send it to the server, all without many big certificate warnings that you would see with outbound connections.
So not only is it easy, this is another example. This is why we're trying to push all of you listeners that have Fireboxes to enable this feature. Because if you don't have it, even though we have a signature, if you are running your OWA in a very insecure and bad manner that I don't recommend either, maybe the signature will help then. But in most cases, most default OWA servers won't get the benefit of the IPS signature unless you do this. And by the way, it's not we do still IPS scan all HTTP, all this other traffic. It's just the fact that the only way to see inside HTTPS is to use our application layer gateway.
Yep. You might also know it as like a reverse proxy, I think is what it's called in the documentation, and as a lot of other vendors
call
it.
We've changed it in so much. Our UI used to literally call this little server the HTTPS ALG. I think it doesn't even have that icon anymore. I think we changed the name. We've called it Deep Packet Inspection. We've called it, but either way, turn it on.
I know reverse proxy is a pretty common terminology for the style of inspection. And on the Firebox, again, it's really easy to set up. Just import that web server certificate on the box. You can even have different certificates for different applications you're hosting behind the Firebox on different ports or IP addresses. If you have more than one public IP, it's pretty dang easy to set up. And then you can turn on all the security services to inspect that traffic. That means IPS to look for exploits like this, but it also means like the anti-malware engines to look for the potential payloads. Like in this case, some of the attacks, they were bringing web shells and deploying them on the servers. And some of those like ASP or PowerShell web shells that they're setting up, or PowerShell scripts they're using to deploy it, or ASP web shells, like you could have visibility into that and potentially inspect and see that payload and block it, so that even if the server is still technically infected by the threat actor, they're not able to get the final payload onto it. It's just one more layer of defense you can deploy then.
And by the way, now that we've acquired a company called Panda Security, you can do this, that second part of, again, you, at this point, you're not blocking the exploit, but you're blocking the bad guy from loading his tools. AD360, it's not just intended for desktops. It's made for servers. You could have that running on your Exchange server as well, like you have on all your other servers and desktops. And it could also catch these web shells as well.
Yep. And when it comes to just securing internal web accessible resources in general, there's other things you can do. Like on the Firebox, we have this thing called the Access Portal. I think it's only on rack mount appliances and higher, just because it does take some RAM to spin up a web server on the Firebox. But the Access Portal, it's basically a clientless VPN. So you can do clientless RDP through it. So you log in through a website, spin up a RDP client or connection through the Firebox in a secure manner. But for things like OWA, we have documentation specifically for setting that up, where basically you're not exposing the OWA application itself to the internet. First, you're exposing the Firebox's authentication portal. And when the users log into that through SSO, they then also log into OWA and get those resources. But long story short, like by not exposing the actual OWA server, that would have mitigated the threat in this case too, because they'd have to hop through Firebox authentication first.
Absolutely. And really, these clientless VPNs are there. Think of them as SSL VPNs without needing the client, because you're just doing everything through SSL or TLS tunneling nowadays. And it's very easy to do a TLS or SSL redirection to internal resources that might be private IPs. But as Mark said, no one on the internet can get to it unless they've gone through this portal and proved that they're part of your organization.
Yep. So even with these actual zero-day flaws in that they were being exploited before the patches were out, like there were still mitigation steps you could have taken on your networks to set yourself up with a fighting chance. Like that said,
I actually think this access portal probably would have been the best one, because regardless of what the vulnerability is, the only reason we ever expose Outlook and Exchange, Exchange we have to expose to the internet, at least on port 25, but Outlook web access, you only want your users to get to that. There's no reason. And the only reason you would expose it to everyone on the internet was before the days you had these TLS redirection portals. So I personally think a major takeaway is never use web-based OWA or any web-based stuff without using this sort of SSO portal.
Yeah.
Unless you don't have a box that can do it and in that case, upgrade or figure out another way.
Exactly. And like it even goes beyond OWA. Like these days with remote work, a lot of our resources we have to expose to the internet for our users, and there are secure ways of doing that. If you even if you don't want to set up an actual VPN and VPN client, like access portals are a really good way of doing that.
It's mostly anything that has a web-based resource can probably be added to our portal. The ones, as Mark said, I think we have, besides RDP, I think there's SSH. It is not a guarantee that every network protocol can be accessed through it, but we do have some like RDP and I think SSH that we have special little helpers for. But anything that's web-based internally, you can put in your portal.
Yeah. So this wasn't the only vulnerability that Microsoft has had to deal with over the past few weeks. So obviously this one was a critical one. They released an out-of-band patch for, but last week was also Patch Tuesday for Microsoft, where they released several more vulnerability patches in other systems. There was, I think, 5 or so remote code execution vulnerabilities in DNS server on Windows Server. Those ones required some specific setups in order to actually exploit, including some configurations that, again, are not most secure, like untrusting, remove record requests from untrusted sources, which is not something you should do. But still, if you've got a DNS server, especially one exposed to the internet, and especially one where you're not quite sure how well you secured it, make sure you patch those as well. But one that I thought was interesting was they actually released a patch for Internet Explorer, or Edge now, I guess, that was a memory corruption vulnerability, where if you remember 2 months ago, we were talked about Google Tag, their threat analysis group, where they talked about they were seeing North Korean threat actors specifically targeting security researchers. And as part of that, they noticed that some security researchers were going to malicious blogs and then sometime later were beaconing home to malware botnet command and control servers. And they weren't exactly sure what was going on. Well, last month, a security researcher out of South Korea was able to find the memory corruption flaw in Edge that these attackers were exploiting. And just now, a month after the fact, Microsoft has finally released a patch for that. So us white hat hackers are now safe.
I got to tell you, Mark, I'm not being a snob. All browsers can have vulnerabilities. But what security researcher uses IE and Edge rather than what I just think of the more common browsers for technical people?
And especially because these were flaws in the old like Edge HTML version of Edge, not the new Chromium-based Edge.
Which is so, more along the lines of a type of browser we might use or based on a type of browser.
I at this point, we are being browser snobs. Let's just get that out there.
Yes, we are. We are.
But like, who intentionally uses Microsoft's original Edge browser? Like,
not only was it
missing just about every feature under the sun, but it has flaws and it like has issues rendering a lot of paint. It's not a good browser. It was slow. It's bad. Like, don't use it.
The new Edge is getting a little better, but
I mean, the new Edge is basically Chrome. Microsoft edition. It's literally Chromium with their own Microsoft wrappers on it. Like, you can use the Chrome store and everything on it. Like, it's a decent browser, as long as you trust Microsoft, who have a history of poor web browsers and poor adoption of web standards.
I don't remember the last time I chose to use a Microsoft browser.
The only times I've used Edge were to test things like our Capture the Flag website to make sure it actually rendered something somewhat resembling a website.
Yeah. Anyways, we'll stop being snobs. Microsoft is actually doing better at security, so I'm just not a fan of their particular browser. Although,
kudos
it is getting
on them.
Much better.
They are getting better at security, resolving a code execution vulnerability 2 months after it was discovered.
Oh, stop making fun. They're way better than they were in the 2000s.
That's possibly the lowest bar you could ever set down.
That is true that it's a low bar, but the Trustworthy Computing Initiative has done some help.
I'm just trying to get an Apple fanboy to continue defending Microsoft, and I'm succeeding.
I defend companies that do decent things.
Now, speaking of decent things in Microsoft.
Yeah, I don't know if I want to defend them for this.
Now that I've got you on the hook for defending Microsoft for the last 3 minutes, sometime over the last couple of days, like security researchers have been creating proof of concept code to like basically exploit these vulnerabilities on Exchange, which is a pretty common thing for security researchers to do. Like, you pull together POC code, not just to say, hey, look, I can hack it too, but so other IT people can take that code, test their systems, make sure that they're not vulnerable or they're safe from it, and to learn from it to potentially secure other products too. One researcher noticed that they had posted their POC code on GitHub, which is still basically the industry de facto code repository for publishing public code. But after a news outlet, I think it was like Vice or something, picked it up and wrote a story about it, GitHub actually went and took down that researcher's code and sent them an email. And the bulk of the email was, quote, "We understand that the publication of distribution of proof of concept exploit code has educational and research value to the security community, and our goal is to balance that benefit with keeping the broader ecosystem safe, blah, blah, blah. Basically, we're still taking it down because it violates our terms of use." So if you missed the news about, 2 years ago now, Microsoft bought GitHub relatively recently.
There's a domain for us to register in our tradition of registering domains on our podcast, BitHub. Exactly. I'm sure that's taken.
I bet you it's already taken.
Keep going.
It's less than 7 characters. It's been registered.
Yes.
Anyway, so I thought this was something worthy to talk about. So is it now their job to police public GitHub repositories to remove exploit code?
I am going to actually defend them a little bit based on their thing. So I believe in full but responsible disclosure. I do believe that proof of concept code should come out and should be published. But the one thing, because what Microsoft said is correct, it's not illegal, it's not a weapon, it educates the security industry. But when I believe in full disclosure, I believe in a version of that called responsible disclosure. And in a normal practice, a good guy tells a vendor about an issue and they have 90 days, they have a time period. The industry is kind of settled on 90 days being the max to fix it before you release the full disclosure. In this situation, it's a 0-day discovery, meaning the good guy never reported, the bad guys did. And that means they never had the 90-day opportunity to get all their ducks in a row. And while technically it's patched, and sometimes the patch is the kind of end of the timer for releasing all the details, I feel like it is a critical enough one that came not through the normal research channel, but bad guys we know for a fact are exploiting it. We also know for a fact that even though all the bad guys didn't know how to exploit it, they can probably now figure it out. But this is just kind of the easy button for it. So I don't want Microsoft to be policing GitHub. The way you posed the question, it's not their job to do that. There's nothing illegal about posting exploit code. And I believe that at some point, it should come out to the research community to use and even to test and to learn from. In this case, because of the extenuating circumstances, I can give them a little forgiveness if the intention is, I don't know, a month from now that they'll stop blocking it and it becomes available. That's the part I don't know. If this is a forever thing and they're never going to take that DMC notice or however they blocked it down, then bad Microsoft, don't do that. But I can have a little bit of understanding here. A thing that me and Mark will tell even young kids about internet security is don't post anything you don't want to live forever because it will live forever. So they might have removed that GitHub page, but that code is now out there, as maybe Mark will share. But I can see their argument for having done it in this case, as long as they allow it a month later. But I think it's too late in any case.
So here's my argument against, I totally understand where you're coming from with that too. Like, it makes sense to protect users by not allowing exploit code out there. But once it's out there, it is too late.
It's not by the way, I'm not saying don't allow it. I'm like, it's just a fresh one. Give them a vulnerability window to make sure that the laggards, the people that haven't patched, have some time to get there.
And that's something followed by a lot of researchers. You'll see a lot of posts where they will describe the vulnerability in sometimes like exceeding detail, but they will hold back on releasing proof of concept code until like a month after the fact to give people time to patch.
Or they'll do opposite. They'll post an advisory about the vulnerability, sharing very little technical detail. And it's not until 3 months later you realize they really knew what they're talking about, because they release a new updated version where all the technical detail for whether there's exploit or not, you can recreate it at that point. But they do something to protect customers for a little bit, but they do believe in full disclosure.
Yep, I 100% agree with that. My counterpoint to your statement, though, is once it's out there, there's no point in trying to remove it. So the Wayback Machine, webarchive.org, already picked it up, scraped it. You can go to the webarchive.org page for that old repository, and the code's all still there.
If you search on Twitter, you're probably going to see 100 people sharing it at this point. It's too late.
Once it's out there, like, threat actors will get it. And the only thing that they accomplished by taking it down off that researcher's repository was getting the word out that, hey, look, we interfered and took it down. And it's basically the Streisand effect at that point, where now people that might not have known that POC was out there because some random researcher had posted it on their GitHub account, now everyone knows. It's all over Twitter. Anyone can find it that wants it. And they've basically negated any net benefit they would have had by trying to remove it.
That is an excellent point. It's probably garnered more attention than it would have otherwise.
Yeah, because like you said, once it's on the internet, it's there to stay. And I think drawing attention to it by enacting the, oh, wait, we own GitHub, let's take it down, is not the best approach to that. Especially because, like, at this point, I'm willing to bet there's a bit of a double standard here. Like, obviously, Microsoft is one of the largest tech companies in the world. Almost everyone uses Windows. A lot of people use Exchange. So you could argue that, yes, maybe taking this down is a net benefit to society. I'm willing to bet that they're not going to go in there and remove a Google vulnerability POC or an Apple POC, only Microsoft ones. And there's a bit of, I mean, yes.
But I don't know. Is this a trend yet, though, Mark?
It isn't.
I don't think there's enough to say Microsoft is policing GitHub yet. This is the first time that I'm aware of, maybe there's more that we're not aware of, that they've done it. So I'm not willing to start saying, oh, they're just doing this to save themselves, not others. Who knows? So I don't think it's even worth that discussion yet until it happens, in my opinion. But I could see why they did it, but I will concede to the fact, whatever, even if they had ultimately pure motives to do it, I actually am won over by the argument that doing it just caused more media attention, which is causing more people to find this exploit, which is now out in the world, regardless of them removing it from GitHub.
Exactly. Either way, though, like, I'm concerned with the precedent it sets in general.
I'm hoping it's not a precedent. So I guess it's something we'll watch. From this point on, is this a precedent, Microsoft? Are you going to be good or bad? Was trustworthy computing really something you believed in?
Exactly. But, I mean, so far, I will give Microsoft the benefit that, like, since their acquisition of GitHub, I've actually been pretty happy. They've turned a lot of paid features into free features. We were able to downgrade our level for some of our accounts.
Don't tell them. I don't want the cost going back into my budget.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, but, what? I mean, you're paying less? Let me up your price, Mark.
Man, in that case, never mind. We've all got super premium ultra pro accounts for everyone. Enterprise grade. We need our own on-prem server for our stuff as well, too, for our small little research team. But anyways, I've been overall very happy with what Microsoft has done with GitHub, especially their integrations with VS Code and Visual Studio. Like, kudos to them. I just hope they don't swing their ownership a little too hard in the other direction on some of these things. So like you said, we'll see. Maybe this was a one-off thing. They've probably learned their lesson, if they were going to learn their lesson, of trying to remove something and having it blow up on the internet. So something to watch out for in the future. Before we hop off, there's one more news story I wanted to cover that I thought was pretty interesting. So way back in April 2019, researchers at TrustWave published an article detailing a malicious email attachment they found that was abusing the ZipX file extension, which is usually reserved for zip archives that are compressed with advanced compression methods, only supported in WinZip and some of the other premium zip on archivers like WinRare and 7-Zip, for example.
Rare. So back, I always love our pronunciation differences.
WinRAR. Whatever.
There's no E.
Whatever. Back then, so they found an email attachment in one of their honeypots with the ZipX file extension that their mail gateway identified as a PNG image. And when you open the actual file in an image viewer, it actually looked like the icon for a JPEG icon. So this was like a whole lot of what the heck is going on here. So as it turns out, it was a PNG image that just happened to be an image of a JPEG icon. But it also had a archive tacked onto the end of the image data. So normally an image, it includes like a trailer behind it, or I don't know, header and a footer, where the footer tells you where the image ends. And so that way the image was still valid. But after that trailing bit of data, there was a archive stuck there. And if you tried to open it in WinRAR, it had no issue finding that actual archive and extracting the payload, which in that case 2 years ago was LokiBot. Well, just this last week, TrustWave published another article detailing the next evolution of this threat, where they found an email attachment called newpurchaseorder.pdf.zipx, which was actually an image file, so an icon binary file. And same deal, though. It had a RAR archive. RAR, see? I'm going to remember it now.
Like a lion says, RAR.
I hate it. yeah, whatever.
Sorry. Have to represent WatchGuard Red, our lion.
Yep. So if the victim clicks the file that says it's a PDF but looks like an icon or is an icon, WinRAR can actually successfully extract the embedded executable inside of it.
By the way, it's bad that it can, but it kind of makes sense, right? Because some of these de-archivers, especially the Windows ones like WinRAR, they want to be your general purpose de-archiver for everything. So obviously, while WinRAR is very good at unarchiving RARs, they want to unarchive any zip, any tar, any type of compressed archive. And I presume that's why their parsers are able to find any sort of archive in a file, even though the heading of, you know, that image heading of the file doesn't mean crap to WinRAR. Probably, but it's doing its best. Hey, I just want to find any sign this is an archive, because then I'm going to do my job happily.
Yeah, I mean, this is it's a malformed file. Like, it's a image file with extra data that shouldn't be there. It's an archive with an image slapped on the front of it.
And technically, the archiver is doing its best to deal with the finding any sort of to its brain normalcy in this malformed file.
You're being hacked by the overzealousness and overachievements of your de-archiver at this point.
I'm really good at unarchiving me anything. Give me anything and I'll find the archive in it.
Exactly. So WinRAR can extract it without any issues. 7-Zip throws a warning, but it does at least succeed in extracting the EXE. WinZip still fails. And in this case, they found the payload was the NanoCore remote access Trojan. And so you kind of just hit on it there. Like, there's a few issues with this type of threat. Like, a lot of tools will rely on those magic bytes at the front of a file to figure out what the file type is, and then based off that file type, make a determination on whether they want to, for example, scan it for malware, if they can potentially de-archive it, things like that. And for this, it looks like a image file, and it is an image file. It's just got data on the back of it that also happens to be an archive. And some of these overzealous de-archivers are able to go through this broken file, find that archive, and extract it. Like, do you think that's a flaw that they should address? Do you think it's a benefit that they can find it?
I mean, it's weird because it is kind of beneficial, right? I think to the de-archiver's perspective, doing everything you can to do your job and give somebody a successfully uncompressed thing that they might have wanted from a file. I presume why they do this is, if you know anything about archives, they're made to send over the internet. All kinds of transmission things can happen to malform the file, so the resulting file you download is wrong. So a lot of these DR, like RAR, builds parity into multiple files. It's designed to do everything it can that if the data transmits badly, there's some way to recover the actual stuff in the archive. So I could see the perspective of why they got to the point to really be good at de-archiving things, but in this case, it definitely is bad.
I've had archives that I've pulled off like a decade old hard drive, like disk drive, that was up in an attic somewhere, where I don't know if it was heat or cosmic radiation or sitting too close to a microwave, like horribly corrupted some of those files. And some de-archivers like WinRAR were able to extract the majority of the contents of them.
I remember old one I don't see anymore. I think it was LZH files, whatever did LZH, where literally for multi-part archives that they would transmit parity archives to. So knowing that you might not be able to get all, this is back in the days of Usenet where people had to share files in lots of segments and parts. You know, nowadays we can send a 4 gigabyte file, no problem, as one file. Back in the day, you split that up into all kinds of parts. And for whatever reason, the way Usenet works with decentralized servers everywhere, if you couldn't get all the parts, if you at least got enough of the parity files, you could still get to it. So I can kind of see how the de-archiving industry has grown to adding all this error correction capability and the ability to handle different files. But this is a very serious ramification of it. Frankly, WinZip is probably doing the right thing by saying, this isn't archive, I don't want to deal with it.
Yep. Like I could understand trying to
extract. I can't believe
a...
I just said WinZip did the same thing, because of the ones mentioned, it's not really my favorite de-archiver.
No, especially as a Mac fanboy.
Shut it.
Like I could see trying to extract a corrupted archive that at least still has like the right magic bytes on the front of it, signifying it's an archive.
Yeah.
I don't like them going deep into a file to try and find that, because it enables this really interesting malware evasion technique. Then,
if the file set at the beginning says it's an image, leave it alone, even if there's something hidden in it. You really don't want to be dealing with it. If there's something being hidden in it, that's really not something you probably want to look at.
Exactly. So it is an interesting malware evasion. Like, there's not an easy solution to it other than, like, this is where your endpoint protection really has to pick up, because it's still, at the end of the day, it's dropping a malware executable on the hard drive, which for endpoint protection is about the easiest thing to detect and block.
I guess the takeaway for a user, there's not much to do other than knowing maybe you should use WinRAR if you're dealing with weird files. But I wonder, the one thing that wasn't clear to me was if this is reported, because frankly, I would expect TrustWave to report this to 7-Zip and WinRAR makers so that they might change their, you know, so for users out there, maybe there will be a WinRAR 7-Zip patch that changes this behavior. I don't know. But if I were TrustWave, I would hope they reported this to those three vendors, and not just hope that the three vendors find this blog post.
Yeah, I agree. I would hope so too. Maybe we'll get a patch out of WinRAR when, you know, one person actually agrees to buy their license, so they're incentivized to release one.
I did buy a WinRAR license once long ago.
You are the unicorn.
Long ago, I actually got sick of the message, and I wasn't a college, you know, pirate anymore. I wanted to be a good boy. But I admit now I just deal with the warning message. I don't use RARs as often anymore.
It's not about the $5 that you have to pay. It's just, you know, it's tradition at this point to say, no, I'm not interested.
But it was at one time my favorite. You got to give them something. They made a good tool. Although it's kind of silly. It's not treating this file right.
Correct. You know, I've used WinRAR enough in the past that maybe I should go ahead and donate or pay for a license. But
give them a coffee.
Yeah, exactly. But at the same time, like, who does that? You actually bought a WinRAR license.
One time, and it was literally when I think every technical person might have gone through college phases where they weren't always perfect. So I'm sure there's other ways to get licensed copies of WinRAR. And I was specifically going through a phase of where I was trying to give credit where credit was due.
Corey's making amends for all his days on the high seas by buying a WinRAR license.
Pretty much.
All right, kudos to you. I don't know what else to say.
We might as well just end there.
Hear that, everyone? Go out and buy a WinRAR license. It'll make you feel a little better about yourself.
But not until they patch this flaw.
Not until they patch the flaw. There we go. Hey, everyone. Thanks again for listening. As always, if you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. If you have any questions on today's topics or suggestions for future episode topics, or if you are an individual that actually purchased a WinRAR license, we'd love to hear from you. You can reach out to us on Twitter. I'm at @XORRO_. Corey's at @SecAdept. And the both of us are at #The443Podcast. Thanks again for listening, and you will hear from us next week.
Mark takes his tips in forms of World of Warcraft mounts. Buy him one.
Those are expensive. That's like a $30 tip.
Except for the new free one.
Yeah, fair. Everyone wants a pet tree.